Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Gulf Meir Synagogue and its School of Jewish Studies here in Cincinnati, Ohio. Pleasure to be with everybody. Hope your eclipse yesterday was enjoyable and in important ways uneventful. Hope everybody's eyesight is still 100% intact. I was so terrified of getting my hands on some of those glasses. What if they're not up to snuff? What if they say that they are and they're not? You know, the retina doesn't really register that it's getting cooked. It doesn't feel any pain. It just goes out. And God forbid a person can really be hurt. So I was really kind of scared about the whole thing. I did, however, see a shadowing on the streets here in Cincinnati, much more so than a normal sunny day. Obviously, the eclipse was hitting, and I think we had 90%. And I did see some crescents falling upon the floor through the leaves of the trees, as they said would happen. So it was really, for me anyway, it was a thrill, and hopefully everybody, wherever you were, you enjoyed safely, and we're back in right now. We're continuing our study of Malachim Aleph, and so let's get started. Last week, we concluded with verse 32. Again, we're in the first chapter. And we are in verse 32, where David is saying, I'll read it the Hebrew. It's a little bit of intro, and nothing wrong with a little chazara, always good. One verse. We're going to start up with verse 32. Lamed Beis. Vayomer HaMelech David. Now again, he's been informed that Adoniyahu has gone off with his buddies, and they're calling him king. And if you recall, it's been a couple of weeks since we met, Batsheva, and hopefully everybody had an enjoyable summer. And yes, Rosh Chodesh Elul Tov to everybody, of course. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017. You remember that Adoniyahu is making himself the king, and David gets word of this, and Batsheva comes in, Nasan Navi has come in, and everybody's informing him, well, what's going on? I thought you made a vow back in the day that Solomon, that your son Shlomo would become the king. So he says, yes, you're right, quite right. And Batsheva bows towards him, and he calls in the team. Now here it is. This is verse 32. V'yom ha-melech David, kirali l'tzadak ha-kohen, l'nasan ha-navi, v'l'vnayo ben yo-yada. Call to me, he says, call me tzadak the priest, call me Nathan the prophet, call me b'nayo ben yo-yada. I want this threesome to come. Vayavo lefnei melech. So they came to before, literally before the king. They presented themselves before the king. And now we can get started with new material. If you're with me, I'm in 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 33. Pasuk Lamed Gimel. Vayomer, and I've actually prepared all this material until like the end of the chapter. It's really an exciting chapter, and it's going to be the coronation of King Solomon. And it's going to be about 20 seconds. I'm not sure if we can get through all of it, but we can get through a good chunk of it. And so, yes, let's get started. Those of you who are listening on the phone, great. If you would be here live in Cincinnati, you'd get some leftover cake, juice, water, seltzer, and fruit salad. Sorry you're not here in person. Hopefully you're enjoying wherever you are. Verse 33. Vayomer HaMelech Lahem. King David said to them, to these three, to Tzadok the priest, Nathan the Navi, and Benayahu ben Yoyada, who's with the army. He said to them, Tichuimachem es avdei Adonechem. Take with you servants of your Lord. What does that mean? Oh, well, wait a second. We're going to try to unpack it. Take with you servants of your master, right? Ve'kavtem es Shlomo b'ni al ha'pirda sherli, and cause my son Shlomo, the harkiv means to cause to ride in the hifil, a verb in the hifil. So cause my son Shlomo, make my son Shlomo ride on the pirda, on the donkey, on the mule rather, which I own, which is mine. Ve'horadetem oso el gichon, and bring him down, cause him to go down to Gichon. Okay, that's the pasuk in its entirety. Now to unpack it, what does David mean when David says, take with you servants of your master? So that does mean, my servants. I'm going to take along servants that belong to me.
The king.
Yeah, take along the king's servants. It's a nice way, I guess, he's speaking in the third person that way. I mean, everybody, it seems, everybody's a servant of the king, right?
And it may be to emphasize that it's not just because it's mine, but it's the king's, it represents the office of the kingship.
Thank you.
What passage again were
you? 33.
What is it, Perek
Aleph? Yeah, Perek Aleph. We still haven't gotten out of Perek Aleph.
I said Malachim Aleph.
Malachim Aleph, Perek Aleph, and Pasuk Lama Gimel. Mr. Brewer, thank you very much. Very right. You know, this is belonging to the office of the king. It belongs to the kingdom. And they're mine, and they're actually my servants. So let me just find, I think the Radak plays on that. First he says, Avdei Adonechem, servants of your master, says the Radak. If you have the Radak, I'll read it for you. Ala kresi v'ala plesi amar. Now, that phrase, kresi and plesi, we all know, is up for grabs. The Targum is going to say, and it's going to come up, in about 5 or 10 more psukim, we're going to see once again this phrase, kresi and plesi. The Targum says that means the archers and the slingers. That's the phrase that's used, because it says it explicitly. So let me see if I can find that. Kashataya the Kalaaya. That is what the Targum says kresi and plesi means. It means either army guys, bodyguards, strong men who, and that's how it's translated over here as well, strong men who bodyguard the king. These are warriors. It's nothing. These guys know how to archery do. They know how to do archery, and they know how to sling rocks, and they know how to fight, and that's what they know how to do. So according to the Targum, that's what kresi and plesi means, and he's pretty consistent with that. According to Chazal, they seem to take a different track. The rabbis of the Talmud and Midrash seem to say that kresi and plesi refers to the Urim Batumim, the Kohanic breastplate that gives you the answers to your questions that you pose to the Almighty, and he answers you in his divine way through the lit-up jewels and stones on the breastplate, the kresi uflesi. Is that not correct? Is that not what the kresi uflesi mean?
I think, I'm almost sure. Who wrote the famous Hecarius form? Is there any other excerpts?
Kresi uflesi, yeah. That is attributed to him. That's right. Okay, so that seems to be a shtick, a little bit of a machlokas, but either way, both work out perfectly. Both work out really nicely. I happen to, if I'm allowed to say such a thing, I prefer the Targumic approach because the whole pasuk is talking about bringing men. You know, get that guy, bring those servants, bring the strong guys, bring the bodyguards, bring everybody. You know, and make sure that it's, you know, secure and everybody's there and the warriors are there. To me, that seems to work in the pasuk. That's just me. That's how I like the Targumic approach to it. That's how, and the Radak brings down kresi uflesi for this phrase, Avdei Adonechem, but he's not done. He also continues over there, Masham, Avdei Adonechem. Apparently a second approach, what she said, this phrase, Avdei Adonechem, servants of your master, what does that mean? Kilu Amar Avadai. It's as if he said, my servants. Remember to bring down my servants. Not just the three of you. We need more than just the three of you over there. We need a lot of my servants over there. Make sure that there's an oilum, if you will, to use a phrase that's popular. Make sure there's an oilum, that there's a community, and it's appropriate. We're going to be coronating a king. This is no small thing. And also maybe for sheer security's sake, bring down the bodyguards and the warriors. Mrs. Brewer, want to answer that?
I want to answer what I said before.
Please.
That he may have chosen to use the phrase, your servant, the servants of your master, because as being the king's servant, then it doesn't matter whether I'm king or whether Shlomo HaMelech becomes the king. They're still the servants of your master. They belong to the king, whomever that may be, so that transfers and it's still the servants of their master.
I like that. I hope that was heard by everybody. As Mr. Bullough said very nicely, it's important to knock into the heads of everybody who's going to be attending that whether you're my servant or you're going to be the new king's servant, you are the servant of a kingship. That's me or my son Shlomo. You're the servant of your master. Your master is, at the moment, me, and in a few moments, in a few minutes, Shlomo will be coronated and installed, and he's going to be your master. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the pirda, which, if it's a feminine parent, which is normally translated as mule. And in fact, Mitzuda Sion, at least, I didn't chance to look at all the Mephorshim, so Sion certainly says it's a mule. Now, one problem is that, of course, the Chatzchila, we're not permitted to crossbreed animals to make a mule. It's true that the product of a crossbreed, however forbidden, is not Osir Bahanoa. You're allowed to use it. I believe, I thought I picked up somewhere in my past that there's one sheet that you're not allowed to ride on a mule for another reason, because of the question of those tachros. You're not allowed to plow with a shor and a chamor, with an ox or and a donkey together, and depending on which opinion you fall in Rishonim, many Rishonim say, I think not the Rambam, that any two species cannot be used that way. And if it's a mixture, it might be considered two species. I think that I picked that up. But there's something beyond that. Next point is, I think that chamor, riding a donkey, let's say, is usually seen, maybe I'm wrong by interjecting more extra Jewish things. I mean, extra meaning not within the Jewish things. I think it's also within our tradition, too, that riding on a chamor, ani rochuv al chamor, is a kind of poverty, not a sign of malchus at all. And it's interesting, Rashi, on the Pirda means mule that he has, or Sheli that I have. Hu simen lo sheyim loch. That is the sign that whoever rides it, such Shlomo, right, will be the king. Utchilas hagedula, in the beginning of greatness. Why? She'ein hahedyot rochev al suso shel melech. Because a commoner does not ride on the horse of a king. So it looks like Rashi is kind of smoothing it over and is kind of assuming maybe that Peret or Pirda is nothing more than a synonym for sus, for horse. He seems to get out of it. I mean, you could argue that Rashi is just trying to tell you the general halacha about a commoner, which is generally formulated, classically formulated, in terms of a sus, that the commoner is not allowed to ride a king's horse. But I'm wondering if Rashi didn't hold that the Pirda really meant a mule, but it simply was another word for a horse, which gets out of that problem. I'm looking at others.
And the problem, and let me just see if I can clarify. And the problem would be if you were to ride on a horse, that would be a problem, you're saying?
No, I'm saying to ride on a mule might be a problem with Shor v'Chamor, plus the how do they get the mule, the goy do it, did the Baal Aveira propagate to, you know, a horse and a donkey to get the mule?
Mm-hmm.
And third, is it, besides the metaphor, the symbolism of anything which is donkey-like, I would think, would not be in conjunction with Malchus.
Uh-huh.
So Malbim goes into it.
Well, but I mean, a susta ha-chamor, that which comes from a horse. A horse and a donkey is a mule.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that is such a negative kind of an animal because of this crossbreeding between a horse and a donkey. Why would a king be riding on a mule? That is the question in front of us right now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Has an interesting
thing.
Right, exactly.
Mal be mal, so I can't figure it out.
Right. We're going to try to say it out, or maybe I'll let Mrs. Brola, because she saw it. It's really good. I think that Barbanel really puts some real good money on this. So let me just make sure that we're still together, and we should be. So, Mrs. Bullough, you have the right to read out, if you like, that footnote that appears, that we see in the Judaica Press translation. It's really good, and it explains why it is that a horse would not be used, but rather a mule would indeed be used. Go ahead, please.
Although David certainly had a personal horse he could have used for the occasion, his use of the mule in this instance had special significance, and David insisted it be used in preference to a horse. A horse is a symbol of war. As it is written in Proverbs, a horse is prepared for the day of war, whereas a mule is a symbol of peace and tranquility. Since Adonaiyahu made for himself horses and chariots, David ordered Solomon to ride on a mule to indicate that Adonaiyahu's warlike actions did not concern him, nor did they instill fear in him. The display of confidence on the part of Solomon belittled Adonaiyahu's efforts to put him to great shame.
Right. Thank you.
The mule served yet another purpose. It symbolized the period of Solomon's reign, which would be a quiet and peaceful one.
Well done. Thank you, Roloff, and thank you, Barbara Nell. Remember, Roloff, when I get in on that?
Right. I just scanned the Malbim, and if I understand the Malbim correctly, it's after saying that, interesting, he says, Ein Hedyot Mishtamesh B'Shavitos O'Melech. He first gets out of the whole thing by not formulating as Rashi, and the commander is not allowed to use the horse of a king. He says the king's scepter or something like that. Mm-hmm. But then he says that extends to any type of animal. And why then would it be a mule according to the Malbim? He says, "How hapirda shelo haisa mekabeles zachor," that at least the way the Malbim understands it, that a female mule, and by the way, I think there's two English words, mule is one, and the other is it hinny, or I think it starts in H-I-N-N-E-Y, or could be I have the spelling wrong, or even the pronunciation wrong, depending on which of the two parents of this crossbred animal is the horse, which is the donkey. But whichever one this is, it says that we're talking now about the mule itself is a female, because it's pirdah, not pered. Shelo oisa mekabela sachar. That apparently, the way at least the Malbim understood it, I don't know if Chazal generally understood it, if it was a commonly held belief, or if it's scientifically borne out, that a mule will not accept, a female mule will not accept the advances of a male.
I thought it was a sterile animal. Am I wrong?
Mules are 99.99% of cases sterile. There have been documented exceptions. Alter Rav Vogel gave me the exact scientific reason why it is highly unlikely for animals that are as distant genetically as those two to have fertile offspring. But at the same time, it's not totally impossible. It has to do with kind of which of the genetic shuffle, the chromosome or genetic material at the meiosis or something, how many they have in common. But anyway, generally speaking, they are infertile. But I don't know if infertile necessarily means that they are sexually inert. I don't know. I don't, normally you don't have a group of them together, I suppose, right? Because since they are normally infertile, you just have as many as the people who are arranging for them arrange for, right? So I don't know that they would normally want to interbreed with a pure horse or a pure donkey or even, I don't know about another mule. Any case, so the symbolism seems, according to the Malbim, is just like the Pirda, the female mule will not accept the advances of a male. So this would symbolize
That I guess that here seems to be a little bit weak. Vazeheraki la molech chenuchedes la melech. That I guess that you know, you just don't accept anybody else. It's riuchat. It's to the melech as opposed to any other animal that wants to consort with it. So that would be a sign of malchus. That probably was a Malbim's attempt to explain why a parrot in particular.
Did you like the Abar Benel's approach that your wife read out?
Yeah, it was.
I like it too. It is symbolically very potent. It seems to me for King David to do things the way he did them. You guys are going to have lots of horses. He's effectively talking to Adonijah. You guys are going to have a lot of horses and a lot of chariots. Not my guy. My son's coming in on a mule. That is as modest a form of transportation as you're going to find, it seems to me, in ancient Israel.
You have a donkey. Why not a straight donkey? Isn't that humility?
I would think so, too. I would agree with that. I don't know if I have a good answer as to why a parrot, a mule, as opposed to a donkey. And please remind me, if you have, you know, if you said it, forgive me, but why a mule then over a donkey, Rabbi? Any thoughts yourself on that?
My own self.
I mean, after all, it's a crossbreed, and it's not, you're saying, it's not a hush of a crossbreed. Is that a fair assumption to make?
I don't know that any crossbreed within Jewish tradition It's a
chashuv,
you know.
But a horse would still be
chashuv. Hmm?
Among animals, a horse would still be.
Absolutely, a horse, absolutely. But why a crossbreed rather than a straight donkey is my question. In terms of the humility, maybe
it's even more humble.
Yeah, right. It's held in contempt because it was had to have been such a nature. Normally, a horse will not propagate a donkey. They will not mate. So normally it's only by human, I think, intervention that one is produced, and the person doing it either would have to be a goy, and I'm not sure, there might even be a shita that's spread out by Sirus. I don't know about crossbreeding. There's a shita that says B'nai Noach are not allowed to, but even allow whether that's a shita is true or not, it's either the guy has to either be a goy, or he's a Jew who's violating the Torah, who was involved in the production of a mule, this mule, right? So it's nothing to be proud of.
When Mashiach comes in, is he going to be going in on a chamor? Isn't that what the pasuk says, okay, that Mashiach will come riding into Yerushalayim on a donkey?
Well, that is certainly a pasuk, but there's another pasuk that seems to say something quite opposite, whether it's from I forget what it is, something very majestic, very ethereal, or whatever. Chazal, I think, they reconcile those two psukim.
Either we're deserving or not
exactly.
Deserving?
Exactly. I'm wondering if parrot for your dog in Tanakh is simply donkey.
Mm-hmm.
And later he will use it uses it for mule. The Mabon or others are, I don't want to say misled because that's not respectful, but they're you know, working out of a later usage of the same word, which is the way the word evolved. Now, I always can think of, let's see, in one case in the, I know where a mule is, according to at least many, referred to in the Torah. And the word used is not parrot, it's yemim, if I have it right, where it says, somewhere in the Sefer Bereishis, that he is the one who is it in the end of Vayishlach, the Edomite who discovered the yemim b'midbar when he was shepherding his father's animals or something, and many say yemim means a mule. But the word parrot, one second, parrot l'mud b'midbar, where does that come from?
That's from the Navi, no? I my Bekidus is not very good. We have to look at in court to see. But I don't know that the word parent comes in the Chumash Chumshei Torah. We would have to look at the references to it, you know, elsewhere in Tanakh.
But it's fair to say that the Metzudas Tzion, he's defining it as he's defining it as an offspring of a horse and a donkey.
Right. I don't want to see that's why reticence where we're on the air and we're just working things out that maybe I may be saying things that are completely untenable, you know.
Okay. We're still getting a lot out of it.
Okay, so we'd have to check it out and make sure that it has to mean a mule. Okay.
Certainly for the Metzudas Tzion, it definitely does mean indeed mean a mule.
Okay.
So the Tzion, was he, can we pin down who that was and when he lived? Does it matter?
The Metzudas, I believe, were a father and son team. I think they were started by, was it a David? I always forget if it was Altshuler or something like that. And then he didn't live to complete it, and his son continued, probably 1600s. I'm thinking I used to know. I would say Altshuler, then I get confused with the Taz. What was the Taz's official last name? Maybe that was Altshuler. So we'll have to look it up. Wait a second. Is it in the back of the Judaica Press?
Ah, that's a good question. Is there a name associated with the Metzudas in the back of our...
When we not look back. Now, what about in the front? Maybe it's only... Does he have his normal introduction?
You're very right. Metzudas David and Metzudas Tzion by Rabbi Yechiel Hillel Altshuler. Thank you. Simple and concise 18th century Bible commentary.
I believe he was a son. I'm almost sure that the father's name is David Altshuler, and that's why it's called Metzudas David, and very likely that he knows, he may know which volumes he put up, which one he did, you know, so this may be the son.
Sure. So that's clarifying a bit. 1700s. And the Malvim, 1800s.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Bless you. So we are continuing on. You should try for all that. Good raid. Pasuk 33. Let's just go back to just for a second and make sure that we hit everything we needed. I want you to bring him down to Gihon, says King David. Bring Shlomo, my son, down to the spring known as Gihon. And take a look at Rashi over there. Rashi says, "Oh Gihon, hu Mayana Shiloach." That's the spring known as the Meir Shiloach, the Shiloach spring. At least that's how I translate the word Mayan. I always knew, you know, thought that that word should be translated as live spring water. But according to the Judaica, it's going to be some sort of well. I'm not sure that that's 100% correct. I always thought that it was a spring. But yeah. The Meir Shiloach is like live spring water. And that's the greatness of the water. That's fresh water. And Yerushalayim was able to get that water, and then people were able to drink it. And later on, it's going to be a factor in the siege. So I always thought that the Mayan is an ever moving spring of water. That was my understanding. And Mikan Shein Moshchin is Samalachim El Alamayan. And that's the reason why you coronate, why you anoint kings to be in Israel, only at a Ma'ayan, only, Rashi says, at a spring, Siman Shetimshoch Malchuso. It's a Siman that his kingship should keep on like moving, flourishing, and so on, and it should be ever flourishing and spring-like and so on. At least that's how I'm translating it, and I think that I'm not off base 100%. So that's what I get from that Rashi, and if anybody wants to weigh in, by all means, you may.
I just going to reminisce for a minute or two, because this reputation lives with me. My fourth and fifth grade rabbi was a young man from the old school. When he came from Israel, straight from Israel, to try out as a teacher in Hillel School in Rochester, I had him for fourth and fifth. So at the end of third grade, he came for a model lesson. And they gave him our class, which they would presumably give him to teach if he were to get the job, which he did. And so this would have been in the spring of 1959. And I don't, whether I had turned 8 or not, could have been either way, depending on the date, if I just barely turned 8 or not. And his lesson was somewhere probably towards the end of Chayisara. And we had Be'er, we had Mayan with Rivka and so on. And I asked him, all in Hebrew, of course, what is the difference between Be'er and Mayan? Are they synonyms or what? And he explained that Be'er is a well of stagnant water and Mayan is flowing water. We have this somewhere, like, you say a bore or a Mayan, similar to two types of what we call a mikveh. So the rain, I'm reminiscing because the class would forget it. When I hydrated him a cup with Be'er and Mayan, one of the other kids who was the son of the conservative rabbi, he said to this tryout teacher, you know, Moshe, this guy Moshe, meaning me, you know, he's always talking. And if I forgot it, the class didn't forget it. So, you know, even if my memory wouldn't have gone back that far, which it did, at least as far as the Be'er Mayan, I don't know about the always talking part. But so this was one of my childhood memories, that Be'er and Mayan are not to be used as synonyms. See, I think the regular teacher had been using them interchangeably, and I was not comfortable with that. So the Torah is changing the terminology, that must mean something different. So here's the opportunity for a different teacher to get him to weigh in on it.
Right.
And that was it. That's a reminiscence. Baruch Hashem.
It's great. I love childhood memories, and you've got quite a few of them, River Girl. They're all good. That's good. I just want to read out what the Judaica Press is over here, B'Shem the Targum and the Rashi, that according to the Targum and Rashi, King David's choice of the Gihon spring was important, symbolically important. And here's what they write. I'll read in English. It was a very placid and quiet brook near Yerushalayim. As it is written, the Pasuk in Yeshaya, chapter 8, verse 6, this people refused the waters of Shiloach that go softly. A Pasuk in Isaiah. Okay, so this Gihon spring, quiet brook, is mentioned in Yeshaya. And it continues, and thereby, this Gihon placid and quiet brook symbolized again the period of Shlomo's reign, which shall be a quiet and peaceful one. Incidentally, over here, according to Targum and Rashi, and this is really where it is, Gihon and Shiloach are synonymous. Both refer to the same body of water. So Gihon equals the Meir Shiloach. That's why Rashi writes what he writes, Humayana Shiloach. Okay? So again, once again, this is a symbolic move on the part of David. Walk him in on a mule. It doesn't get any lower than that. Walk him over to a quiet brook. It doesn't get any quieter than a quiet brook. We're not going to make enormous, we're not going to symbolically overcome the opposition. We're going to go the other way. We're going to take the high road by coming in quietly, peacefully, having it done in a quiet locale, and that's going to counter all the fireworks that seem to be going on with Adoniyahu and his team. And according, listen to this, if I may, the Abarbanel also writes something very nice over here. We find yet another purpose in choosing Gihon as a site of the appointment, the anointment. David wished to counter each move of Adoniyahu and to outdo him. Adoniyahu went to Ein Rogel, which was a small stream. Shlomo went to Gihon, which was a large body of water. Okay.
So much for the well.
Yeah, so much for the well. I guess maybe I misread it. But a placid and quiet brook on the one hand, a large body of water, I guess you can make them both reconcile. Adoniyahu was assisted by Eviatar, who was dismissed from the priesthood, from the kahuna. But Shlomo was anointed by Tzadok, the true Kohen of God. Adoniyahu was assisted by the evil Yoav. I want to get back to that in a moment. Shlomo was anointed by Nassan, the holy prophet, chosen by God. Adonijah was secretly proclaimed king. Shlomo was announced by great trumpets and jubilant shouting voices, proclaiming, "Long live King Shlomo." So says the Abarbanel. So that's what's going on over here. I get, apparently, maybe I wasn't so 100% right when I said a lot of fireworks. According to this, they went to Ein Rogel, which according to the Abarbanel was a small stream. And he was assisted by a man who had been dismissed from the priesthood. So maybe, you know, it wasn't such, maybe all the bells and whistles were not going, I don't know, I thought that it was like some kind of big, big Gedilla going on over there in Ein Rogel.
I mean, he was trying to make it
one. He was trying to make it one, Mrs. Broloff says, and I think you're quite right, Mrs. Broloff.
What
he was trying
was
to, where he was trying to make a big Gedilla over there? Yeah. It seems to be testimony coming up from,
maybe?
Let's see.
Well, let's close the cookie. Ra Azayin, Azayin, Tess and Tess.
Yes, thank you.
Starts with
A. That's Aaron. Yeah, you're right. All those cookies. But the A, right, the Aaron have Rogel, ain't Rogel, and the red is in Tess. Who, where do we know that Eviezer was deposed? Or when was he deposed?
It doesn't say so in our psukim over here that I've seen. Well, you know what's coming up over here? Eviatar the Kohen. I have some footnotes in English that I'd like to read to be able to answer Rabrilov's question. How do you know that Eviatar the Kohen was deposed? So I think I do have some answers over here. And it could be that Rashi's also writing it. They seem to be quoting him. Eviatar had been loyal to David. But because he was dismissed from the Kahuna at the time when David was escaping from Yerushalayim, because of Avshalom, and those are Rashi's words, he felt that he had been slighted. Moreover, Eviatar had noticed on several occasions that David had given more honor and preference to Tzadok, the Kohen, and to Tzadok's opinions. So says the Abarbanel. Then they give us the actual incident. I'm continuing to read in the English of the footnotes, giving us a Gemara in Yuma. His dismissal was a result of the following incident. A rabbi said in Yuma 73b, quote, "Only a Kohen possessing Ruach HaKodesh, prophetic inspiration, and Shechina, also divine presence, only such a Kohen has got Ruach HaKodesh and the Shechina, may receive a response from the Urim and the Tumim, the breastplate. When Eviatar consulted the Urim and Tumim and was unsuccessful in receiving a response, he was removed from the Kahuna, as it is said in Shmuel Beis, chapter 15, Shmuel Beis, 2 Samuel, chapter 15, verse 24. Eviatar went up, which according to our sages indicates he was removed and replaced by Tzadok. By going up, according to Chazal, he had been removed from his job. I wouldn't have thought that, and I'm sure that we actually probably talked that out when we read it the first time. I wouldn't have thought that language saying that somebody's going up is an indication that he's going down, that he is being terminated, that he's being demoted. But that, for our rabbis, that is, I guess, the context was suggesting that.
Being kicked upstairs.
Kicked upstairs to another job. And finally, one last but rather long paragraph. I'll read it out. Eviatar also, upon witnessing the termination of his prophetic inspiration, he realized the time must be at hand for the curse of Hashem to take effect on the base Eli, on the house of Eli. He was a descendant of Eli. Eli, in turn, was a descendant of Itamar, the son of Aaron. Whereas Tzadok was from the mishpacha of Pinchas, who was the recipient of the godly blessing of an everlasting covenant of Kahuna. So instead, Eviatar was coming from Eli, and Eli was working under a klola because of what had happened in the very beginning of First Samuel, his sons were not working out. His sons were not behaving. And this is a pasuk in Shmuel Aleph.
Yes, and that's ongoing.
And it's ongoing. Right.
So that's the curse of
Aleph
was a permanent curse.
Wow. It's just amazing that it was.
In case you have any questions about how long that goes on, Rabbi Reisman said, I don't forget how long ago it was, that, you know, he had, that there it was still going on. And it made me wonder if that's what happened with Ray Levy, Lashon's nephews. Their father died, and all of them died.
Hmm.
And they were Kohanim. And I wonder if maybe they were from
so
Ailey.
Because
it was a genetic kind of thing.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't really know. That's fascinating. We have people here locally who lived here in Cincinnati, and Mrs. Brother was saying that that family suffered premature deaths all in the family. These are young people, Mrs. Brother?
Well, premature age 30s, 40s, I don't know. Right.
That's pretty early.
All of the males.
All the males passed at a very, very early age, you're saying.
Right.
So you're saying that it's not the case necessarily that the house of Eli would be wiped out. Rather, they would live in Israel, but they would still suffer this curse, potentially of this, wow, Adi Yamazeh, you're saying. And Rabbi Reisman, what was his insight into this?
That
it still continues on, even to this day.
He said that it was at least until, I forget how many years ago he said, maybe 100 years, 200 years, so it could, there's no reason to think that if it lasts until then, that it stopped then.
Uh-huh. Rabbi Reisman and Shira was saying that it lasted very, so very, very recently.
Right. So I'm speculating that it continues.
Right. Well, that's super, super interesting and terribly saddening to hear that, if it's accurate. Yeah.
They must have lived long enough to have children, though, to pass it on.
Right. Right. Okay, let me just read this out. If I thank Shreach again for that. Pasuk in Shmuel, First Shmuel, chapter 2, verse 35. Is that possible? No. Eviatar knew that he would not serve in the days of Shlomo, for he was said to Eli, and here's the pasuk. Now I'm going to read you the pasuk from First Shmuel, chapter 2, verse 35, where Hashem says, I will raise me up a faithful Kohen, he shall walk before my anointed one. That's the pasuk in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Beis. Eviatar preferred, therefore, that Adoniyahu become king through his assistance. Thereby, he would create the possibility of prolonging his tenure in the priesthood in return for his efforts on Adoniyahu's behalf. So says Rashi. That there's some quid pro quo going on over there. I'm going to help you become the king, and maybe I'm going to get some extra life out of this, and maybe some extra, get the job back, who knows. So this is what's going on. It's fascinating. Okay. Let's go back in. All right. Pasuk Lamed Daled, Umashacho Sosham Tzedek HaKohen, Benasan Anavi, Lemelech Al Yisrael. And Tzadok, the Kohen, will anoint him there, meaning Shlomo, and Nasan and Avi will be in on it too as king of Israel. And the Mefarshim, I'm going to say later, it's like 10 psukim from now, Pasuk seems to say explicitly that Tzadok the Kohen does indeed anoint him. That seems to be explicitly what the Pasuk says. And says one parshan over there, no. It's not that the Kohen is anointing him. The Navian has to anoint him. And Nassan is doing it. Doesn't say that in that Pasuk 10 second from here, but it is intimated right now in 34, where David is saying, Tzadok the Kohen and Nassan and Navi, though the verse is in the singular, and Tzadok seems to lead off. Umashach Sosham Tzadok HaKohen. The Nasan Hanavi, Lamelech al Yisrael. It looks as if Tzadok is going to be the one doing it. Because it's a verb in the singular, and his name comes up first. I would think that he's the Kohen. No, it's another king.
You could also argue that Nathan's name is closer to the verb.
Well, the verb is always very early on. The verb is over there, Mashach or something, right? Starts off the Pasuk. And so Tzadok's name is the one that's closer in verse 34. But at all events, this is how David phrased it. He puts the verb in the singular. He's mentioning two people, the verb's in the singular. And the one who's going to do the action ultimately is going to be Nasan and Avi. Tzadok's name comes up earlier next to the verb, okay? At all events, this action is going to be done. Anointing will be done. And he's going to become Melech HaYisrael. And that's how we're going to do this. Uskatem b'shofar. You will blow the shofar. V'amartem, you will say, Yechi HaMelech Shlomo. Long may King Shlomo live. Let the king live. That is the divine, the temporal, the mundane, divine command of King David to his servants Tzadok, the Kohen, and Nathan, the Navi. And that's how he wants it done. Okay?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like a joint effort that Nathan is the one who proclaims who is to be king, and the Kohen is the one to the actual anointment.
Okay. Mrs. Billard, you're suggesting that maybe the actual anointment is going to be done by a Kohen, by Tzadok the Kohen. So let's go to the pasuk where this actually does take place. Let's get out of the bag, because we're not going to get to it tonight, but we will. Let's just go right over there and see how the anointment does it. Let's go over there. Here we go.
Lamites.
Yes, Lamites. V'ikach tzadok ha-kohen. As Karen, we'll skip a little bit for the moment. V'ikach tzadok ha-kohen as Karen, Hashem min ha-oel. Tzadok ha-kohen took the horn, not a literal horn of oil, we're told, but it looks like a horn, it's a keli. A horn of oil of shemen min ha'oel from the tent, from the they translate from the tabernacle, the Mishkan. Uvayimshach Shlomo. He anointed Shlomo. Who's he? According to the pasuk, it sure looks like the man who is taking the oil. Looks like he is anointing. But if you take a look at the mefarshim, it's not so pashut. One second, we'll go right there. I'm going to ask you to take a look at page 14. Please turn over, if you've got the Judaica Press, please turn to 14 on the left-hand page, on the left-hand side page, and there you'll find it, right side paragraph, last paragraph on the right-hand side. I'll read it in English. Apparently, Tzadok the priest, just plug in. Apparently, Tzadok the Kohen was the one who anointed Shlomo. Oh, no, I don't want it to power off. I don't mean to do that. Good, I think we're still right. Apparently, Tzadok the priest was the one who anointed Shlomo, as the simple translation indicates. However, this is not so. The oil was perhaps in the custody of the Kohen Gadol, and he probably assisted in the anointment. Yet the only one who had the authority to anoint the king was the prophet, who, in this case, was Nathan. And so says the Abarbanel. So even though the pasuk that we just read, 34, was it 34? Looks like Tzadok has got to be the one doing it. And even though pasuk 39 seems to actually say it, Tzadok took the oil, he anointed Shlomo. For the Abarbanel, no, he anointed Shlomo just means Nathan anointed Shlomo, but Nathan didn't get his name in to the pasuk for whatever reason. We're told that Yirmiyahu HaNavi was writing the facts of Sefer Melachim. And so according to this, the prophet Yirmiyahu, who authored the facts, recorded in this book of Kings, He wrote in a certain exaggerated manner, okay? But who actually is it? Who actually wrote Sefer Melachim? Was it Yirmiyahu himself, or did he just simply record facts? But these facts clearly preceded him. Obviously, he was not living during this time. He lived much, much, much later. He lived at the very tail end of the First Temple. We're talking about the very beginnings of the First Temple with the installation of King Solomon. So at least 400 plus years, and for maybe some scholars a little bit much more than that, 500 years. Either way, it's centuries. But according to our tradition, Yirmiyahu recorded the facts that comprise the Book of Melachim. I find that fascinating. I would have thought that maybe Nassim had done that, because Nassim the Nappi was living at that time, intimately involved in all these actions, and who better than Nassim the Nappi to have written it down? Maybe he actually did author the book, but who can know? Who can know? If Nassim authored it, then what role does Yirmiyahu play in it? I don't know. Are we saying that Melachim was written in the time of Yirmiyahu HaNavi?
Well, you have to listen to the sources. You have to look it up.
Right.
I'm sure it did Melachim span a wide range of time.
You're talking about the books, not the Judaic press might say.
Mr. Rollo's point is still, it does span centuries, doesn't it?
So therefore, who's to say that, you know, it wasn't started by one prophet who was living at that time and continued on? I don't know.
We're not going with what we conjecture. They're going with the statement of Chazal, probably from Baba Basra, who authored what.
Right.
That's something that seems to be looked up.
Right.
You may have it in the beginning.
Okay. Does the rule of anything want to add?
I wanted to say, first of all, using a singular verb when there are multiple subjects...
Not uncommon.
Is not uncommon at all, when each multiple subject itself, or at least the first one, is in the singular. Is not uncommon. The second point, if we hold by the Abar Banel, and again, there too, one would have to check if the Abar Banel is simply stating a commonly accepted a principle or a chiddush that a melech had to be anointed by a navi, not by a kohen, so that the corollary of that would be once there were no longer any neviim, so either there'd be a category, I don't know if there is a category of a kosher melech Yisrael, something analogous to when we have kohanim gedolim. We have two categories, right? We have the original ones that had the Shemen HaMishcha, and then in the Second Temple time, when there was no Shemen HaMishcha, you had the Merubah Begadim, they're called, that they were distinguished from a regular kohen merely by wearing an extra clothing, and not by the Shemen HaMishcha. So I'm wondering if there is a Heicha Timtzum, if there is within Rabbinic Judaism an admissibility of having a melech who was not anointed at all, simply because there would be no Shemen HaMishcha, or for that matter, a Novi to anoint him. And maybe they went together. I don't know exactly when the Shemen HaMishcha disappeared, maybe before the Neviim, last Neviim. I don't know, because usually I think the chap against Chazal had against the Malachim Ibeis Chashmonoi, the Hasmonean kings, was the fact that they were of Kohanic descent rather than from descent of Yehuda in particular, general, and David HaMelech in particular. So they're not legitimate kings who have to be descended from Yehuda and from David. If that was the only objection or not. Let's say somebody at the time of the Bais Shadi was a descendant of Malchut Yehuda. Would they be allowed to serve as a melech l'chatchila with all the dinim of a melech, notwithstanding the fact that there was no Shemen HaMishcha? I don't know. Because it's interesting, because a Navi, until Mashiach comes, at least, is a very time-limited thing, right? So it seems that there has to be an element of miracle for each king
I don't know. Did they continue to anoint all the kings in Bais Rishon? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. We have to look into that.
Not Malchei Yisrael.
There is a little footnote over here about the oil, and also Rashi talks about it. Let's take a look at it. We're winding up. I've got 5 more minutes. So let's go ahead and see what we can see regarding that pasuk where it says, you shall anoint him, referring to Tzadok and Nasar. Okay? Let's take a look at the Rashi says, "V'mashach aso nosem lo shemen ben risei enav kimin nezer." You should put it between the risei enav, the lids of his eyes, in the form of a crown. Take a look.
Look, at Rashi had a diagram. My Rashi is kaveh.
Kimin. I don't have that.
Interesting, because kaveh. Usually, it appears more in Rashi in Shas, is when Rashi gives you a picture, a diagram.
Mm-hmm, yes. Over here, but I see the word Nezer coming up, and not Kizeh. Those are certainly...
We have both, Kimin Nezer, Kizeh.
Well, all I've got is Kimin
Nezer. That's
yeah.
It.
Right. I'm going to read a little bit over here for time's sake. Although the sons of a king don't require anointment, for all future, they can be quoting the Radak and the Ralbag right now. Although the sons of a king don't require anointment, Mashiach, for all future generations, nevertheless, because of the opposition of Adoniyahu, David felt this unusual procedure was necessary. He's looking at the Radak and the Ralbag. The Judaica press man is, and quoting that down, that's the reason why. Says the Radak in the Hebrew, if there was no reason to anoint him with this Mashiach of Israel, Shemoshcha Melech Ben Melech, so you don't have to, you don't anoint a king, the son of a king. Ki kishenimshach David lo ulazaro nimshach lemalchus, because when David was anointed, he and his posterity were anointed for kingship. So there's no need to go ahead and do this for Solomon. You don't have to anoint Shlomo. It's already been done in the Mashiach that was given and done upon David. Wow. Because of this whole machloikis, this whole battleground fight between Adoniyahu and Shlomo, David felt, I've got to do this action of anointing, to make it clear as day to everybody. Amazing. And there's a little bit more. This anointment, however, was not over the entire body. This would be absolutely impossible. The only oil available for anointment was the same oil that Moshe had prepared in the desert. This horn of oil which he took was an extremely small amount, barely sufficient to, and here, quoting Rashi, to anoint him between the lids of his eyes in the form of a crown. The remaining oil was spilled on his head. Rashi cited from Harius 12a, and also see the Ralbag. And also they don't, in Pasuk 39 is going to be a whole discussion about this very special oil that's going to be brought back together. It's going to be made again to anoint Mashiach when the Messiah comes, descendant of David. We're going to have oil. Of course, my question is, according to the Radak, I hate to ask a silly question, I don't want to get a silly answer, but the Radak just quoted the idea that when David was anointed, that anointment theoretically was for all time of the Davidic dynasty. That's what the Radak writes. I didn't write that. The Radak writes it. I'm going to go along with it. I bazai. So if that's true, Why would we need to anoint the Mashiach, he being part of the Davidic dynasty? Am I wrong for even asking? Am I out of touch or off base with this? Rabbi Berlov wants to correct me. Why the need to anoint the Mashiach, the Mamash, the Mashiach, the anointed one, if David was already anointed, and it says, that's Mamash for him and forever. Lo ulazaro nimshach l'malchus. For him and his children after him. So why the need to anoint the anointed one?
First of all, are you absolutely sure that we do? Or is he simply called Mashiach, Mashiach because, you know, he is anointed halakhically as the descendant of David? I'm just throwing that out as a possibility. However, I think the answer follows very well with this, because this tells us why. A Ben Melech who is succeeding his father undisputedly, let's assume he's the only son, or he's the oldest son and nobody else is contesting it, or putting up a brother as a candidate, so then there's no need to do a physical act of Mashiach. But obviously the Mashiach that we're looking for is not following straight in an obvious way from his father having been king. So obviously there is going to be a potential, you know, that at least read it for immediately what that one of those Yiddish sing modern contemporary you sing that song a number of years ago. Whose car did I hear that in? Where Mashiach comes, you know, the Sattler won't accept him because he's a Lubavitch, very basic. That group won't accept him because he's wearing the wrong color hat, and so on. At least initially, it's not clear that all of Klal Yisrael will accept him. So this Eliyahu Hanavi indeed will be around and do a physical Mashiach. That would be about exactly the same situation here to vitiate, you know, the legitimacy of his Mashiachius.
I hear.
I think.
Sounds good to me. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we'll wrap it up. Shakar, thank you both so much. Reverend Mrs. Rutherford, for joining us. Friends out there in phone land, thank you so much for calling in. Wishing everybody a good rest of the week and a good Shabbos. God willing, we will meet again next Tuesday night. And, of course, those of you who join us on Sunday night, you're welcome to do that, too. Both classes begin at 7:30. Everybody's welcome to phone in. Wishing everybody from Cincinnati, Ohio, Gulf Manor Synagogue's School of Jewish Studies, Shmuel Plotzker here signing off. Wishing everybody a good week and a good Shabbos. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.
Yeah.